News read by Andrew Peach.
Sir Keir Starmer has promised a Labour government would reduce net migration, the number of people moving to the UK legally, minus those that leave, if his party wins the general election. Labour has also set out plans to train British workers to plug skills gaps, but have refused to set a target for how much net migration would fall. The Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, has defended the government's record on the NHS as the Conservatives set out plans to build more GP practices in England and expand services offered by pharmacies. The Liberal Democrats are promising more money for local councils by reversing cuts to their public health grants. And the SNP will formally launch the party's general election campaign this afternoon. At a rally in Glasgow, the leader, John Swinney, is expected to urge voters to put Scotland's interests first, saying that independence would offer a better future. Volodymyr Zelensky is accusing China of prolonging the war in Ukraine by supporting Russia. The Ukrainian leader complained Beijing was discouraging others from attending a planned summit in Switzerland later this month. China says the failure to invite Russia to the meeting undermines its value as a peace forum. South Africa's ANC has said it's willing to talk to all parties in the country as they look to create a coalition government after losing its majority. Its Secretary-General, Fikile Mbalula, said the party had nothing to celebrate and denied underestimating the threat from the former president, Jacob Zuma. Mr. Zuma's MK party received almost 15% of the vote, but said it would only work in a coalition if President Jacob Zuma stepped down. More balloons carrying rubbish from North Korea have dropped over the border into South Korea. Military personnel were clearing up waste from around 600 balloons sent overnight. The barrage is in retaliation for bundles dropped in North Korea by activists which contain cash, food and devices containing South Korean songs and dramas. David Beckham has been sharing beekeeping tips with the King during a conversation at a meeting at the monarch's Highgrove residence. The ex-England football captain will become an ambassador of the King's Foundation. The weather this afternoon, the north will turn cloudy, spells of rain developing across northwest Scotland, dry and sunny further south. BBC News and weather, it's 2 minutes past 12. And now on Radio 3, it's time for Private Passions, presented by Michael Barclay.
Dorothy Byrne worked in journalism for more than 40 years, including almost 20 as head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. And she's not afraid of making a few headlines herself. When she gave the MacTaggart Lecture at the Edinburgh Television Festival in 2019, she detailed the sexism and harassment she'd experienced as a young producer. But she added that she would still recommend journalism to young women today, saying, "In what other line of work, when some bastard annoys you or you hear of some absolute disgrace, can you say to yourself, 'I'm going to make a programme exposing that and I'll put a stop to it'? And sometimes you even do." And now she's president of Murray Edwards College, a women-only college at the University of Cambridge, a post she's held since 2021. I think your first music, Dorothy, comes very much from your childhood, growing up in Paisley in Scotland in the 50s. What were those early musical memories?
Well, we didn't have a radio because my father said he had four daughters and if he got a radio, they would just torment him. And we didn't have a record player. So the only music I knew was hymns. And I loved hymns.
Catholic hymns.
Catholic hymns. Yeah. Of course, we couldn't sing Protestant hymns.
And amongst your possible aspirations at that time, I think, was a nun.
Yes. People are surprised when I say that I had originally thought seriously about being a nun. But then I say I also thought of being a bus conductress and a hairdresser. And I realise that's probably because they were the only women I ever saw who were working. I'm very glad I didn't become a nun. I don't think it would have suited me at all.
Those hymns meant that you explored other music, like our first piece?
Yes, when we were nine, my father finally relented and we were allowed to have a record player. And my mother purchased Panis Angelicus by Gili, and I thought it was the most beautiful song I had ever heard. And the way that Gili sings, it's like the whole of his being is crying out.
Beniamino Gili singing César Franck's Panis Angelicus.
Sitting, hearing it now, I feel just the same way about it as I did when I was a little girl. And in my imagination, he had died because he was so broken-hearted, and the women singing were angels. I used to picture that he had climbed into his coffin, which was made of white silk, and he was still singing as he lay in the coffin, and the angels pulled him up to heaven. And when I grew up, I discovered that it was all about transubstantiation. So I was sort of right.
So your parents met in the civil service and were both Catholic. How would you describe them?
I'd describe them as quite unhappy. Mm. I don't think they had an expectation of great happiness. Now young people think they should be happy, but for them it was about duty. But my father had assumed he would die in Burma. And the thing that he used to always say to us is, I was sure I would die. I never thought I would marry. And I never thought I would have children. And one day he said to me, I ask myself, what is the purpose of my life? And the purpose of my life has been to have you, my children. And that's actually an extraordinarily empowering thing, that your father should think that you were the purpose of his life.
And was it happy for you, a happy childhood?
No, it was a very unhappy childhood. I was very, very unhappy. And I think that's why I liked sad music. Some people think that listening to happy music will make them happy. But I find that if you listen to heartbreaking music and then you cry, it releases your unhappiness. But now I'm a very happy person. And I encourage all my students to be happy, and I put their well-being and their happiness very high because I struggled so much with being an unhappy child.
Your next choice is Mozart. So how did you come across this and when?
Somehow I had heard Mozart, and in particular the piano concerto in D minor, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. So I actually saved up so that I could buy. This was my first LP that I ever bought. It's so happy. And when I listen to it, I picture all these very serious men, no offence men, many of them bald, and they're all sitting very, I'm not saying you're completely bald, you've got lovely hair where you have it. And they're all sitting very seriously in a room playing music. And suddenly, through the window, a butterfly flies in. And the butterfly, who's a female butterfly, of course, flits round and round the room. And sometimes she pauses a bit and lands on their head. And then she's off again. It's the most wonderful piece. Thank you.
Mitsuko Ushida, directing the Cleveland Orchestra from the piano in the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 in D minor. I'm really fascinated, Dorothy Byrne, that you talked about that as being happy music. And I think that may be a reflection of where you were in your life and that discovering it was happy, because in some ways it's some of Mozart's most dramatic music, almost looking forward to Beethoven.
Discovering that music was transformatory, and I see, because I listened to it again for this, that some of it's really very, very serious, but that's not what I took from it.
Did it make you want to play the piano?
Yes, I wanted to play the piano, and I used to lie in bed at night and move my fingers across the pillow and sing. And eventually my parents said I could have piano lessons, and I was so disappointed to discover that you had to actually learn the notes. I thought if you just sang, the music would come. And I did enjoy playing the piano, but at the school that I went to, they had a concert every year. And even although I had just begun playing, I had to play with my friend Anitra's Dance by Grieg. And I cannot think of any more terrifying experience I have ever had in my life, having to play to a whole hall full of people. So I associate this piece with being absolutely terrified.
Do you think that going through that experience in some way helped you to learn to overcome being in public, addressing people?
No, I think it did the opposite. I think it made me really terrified, so that I didn't want to do that at all. And it was only when I got to be about 14 that I began to realise that I could speak quite well in public, and my school began to see that I could perhaps represent the school in debating competitions. Even although I only went to a little convent, I beat all the posh boys' schools and won the national debating competition, and then at university, the freshers' debating competition. So I went on to be a very confident person, but I think making me do something before I was ready for it was counterproductive, and I would never push a child into doing something they didn't want to do.
Your father wasn't very keen on the playing, was he?
Well, of course, he had always had this fear of music in the house, that it would take over. The piano was in the living room, and on a Saturday morning, he would sit reading the Daily Telegraph and doing the crossword. And at first, I was so keen, I would just play the same piece all morning, and he used to pay me not to play, which really was not a good thing for a father to do. But by the time I was 15, I wasn't quite so keen, and I spent the money for the grade 5 piano exam. So I told my parents I'd failed, and my father was clearly relieved and said, well, if you failed, there's no point in you having lessons any longer. And so I gave up playing so much. But I'm sorry about that.
I think we should hear this piece nevertheless, Anitra's Dance.
Thank you.
Does that still recall the terror?
I've got over the terror. That just makes me feel so happy.
Anitra's Dance from Grieg's Peer Gynt in the composer's own arrangement for piano duet, played there by Anthony Goldstone and Caroline Clemo. You studied philosophy at Manchester University, Dorothy Byrne, didn't you? Then decided to travel to Nigeria as a volunteer teacher. Were you hoping for adventure there?
Yes, and I did have adventure. I love Nigeria. I lived in northern Nigeria, and it breaks my heart now to see what is happening in northern Nigeria with Boko Haram and the terrible levels of fear that children now live with, being kidnapped and terrorised in their own schools. I lived in the bush and I loved after school, which would finish at about midday, I loved just running through the bush and I would run round the houses of our compound and people would sit out and just stare at me in amazement with the idea that somebody would just run for fun. It was before the days of jogging or anything. But all ended very sadly because they gave us little motorbikes so that we could go out to local markets. And my motorbike seized up and I fell off and injured myself very badly and had to be flown home. It was a possibility that my leg would be amputated. And I was in plaster for a year. And during that time, they told me that I would never work again. Now I can't believe, why did they tell me I would never work again? People with no legs work. They told me I would never walk normally again. But although my leg was saved, it doesn't bend very far. It doesn't walk very well. As a person who used to love running everywhere, I feel trapped in my body. And even now, sometimes at night, I dream that I'm running and then I wake up and I'm not running. But the thing which I have discovered which really helps me is ballet. So when I'm watching ballet, my whole body is moving in my head and I'm one of the ballet dancers. It was like magic when I discovered it.
Have you chosen a particular ballet?
Yes, I've chosen. I love the Royal Ballet and I love their short modern ballets, which they do. And this is the music of Max Richter, Wolf Works. And when I saw the ballet about Virginia Woolf, which this music accompanies, it's extraordinarily moving. Particularly when it comes to the moment when she is overwhelmed by her mental illness and she cannot go on any longer. Watching that ballet is one of the most moving experiences that I've ever had in my life.
Part of the Waves, Tuesday, from Max Richter's music for Wayne McGregor's 2015 Royal Ballet production, Wolf Works, inspired by the novels of Virginia Woolf. I'm Michael Barclay, and you're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3. For details of all today's music, and to explore hundreds of previous episodes, please head to BBC Sounds. Dorothy Byrne, how did you come to be a journalist? Did you want to be a journalist? Well, did you realise that?
I'm very ashamed to say that I was thinking of being a barrister, and my boyfriend of the time said, you wouldn't like being in a dark court all the time. You're always angry and you really like people. You should become a journalist. And he was right. It completely suits me because I really am interested in and I like other people and I'm outraged all the time. So I started on a local paper and worked my way up as people used to. And I ended up getting a job on World in Action at Granada TV, which was my dream job. I couldn't have ever imagined that I, the person who wanted to be a nun, ended up working on what was the best current affairs television programme in the world. And one of the things that I discovered was that when you made your film, you got to choose the music for it. Nowadays, on the whole, because I still am involved in making films, we tend to get specially composed music. But then we would just grab music from anywhere. So I would plaster any music that I loved onto my film. And my favourite ever use of music is music from The Magic Flute, which I had just heard this tune and I thought it was fantastic. And I was making a film about housework. We had Vitruvian Man by Leonardo as our title sequence. And Vitruvian Man, as you know, is a naked man with lots of arms. There was no such thing as digital then. So I got a real naked man and I put an apron on him and I filmed him in a studio. So that when you started to watch this programme, a man in an apron appeared and then a giant pink duster went across the screen and brushed him away. And the editor of World in Action was absolutely furious that I had done this to the iconic title sequence of World in Action. And only later did I discover that The Magic Flute has the most terrible sexist story and that the music I had chosen was an evil woman saying that if her daughter didn't stab a bloke to death, she would disown her. Well, I took the music and I reinvented it for the feminist era. Thank you.
The Queen of the Night's aria, sung by the soprano Diana Damrau.
When I listened to it just now, it does sound like a woman being really angry that she has to do too much housework. So I think I should rewrite the libretto of the opera to turn it into a story about enraged women rising up and refusing to do housework.
I was wondering whether actually it was transmitted, the thing that drove the oil producer crazy.
Yes, it was. And the reason he went crazy is he first saw it on television. You couldn't get away with that now. But it was great. I like to annoy people.
Did it in any way enhance your reputation, do you think, on a wider basis?
When I first worked on World in Action, at that point, I was the only woman working on the programme. And at that time, the suitable subjects for current affairs were the CIA, the dangers of nuclear power or nuclear weapons. And there wasn't nearly so much about domestic violence, sex abuse, rape. A whole number of us, as women, started to enter television current affairs and make programmes about subjects that men would never have thought to make programmes about. And housework is actually a really serious subject. So many women are going out to work all day and having to do all the housework. It is a form of economic and social and marital oppression which should be exposed.
So now you had this dream job, Dorothy Byrne, but you discovered that there were some considerable downsides. In your 2019 McTaggart lecture, you spoke about sexism and harassment you experienced at work.
Yes, it was regarded then as quite normal for men to assault and harass women, and a number of the people doing it were the bosses, and therefore there was nobody to complain to, and people would joke about it. And now it seems extraordinary that actual assaults were overlooked.
So do you think now that the things that were happening to you, the boss wanting to go home with you, hands up skirts, that wouldn't happen now?
I think in big companies, things are much better, partly because the law changed, partly because women made complaints and men ended up being taken to court. And I don't think they got more moral. I think they got scared. But I think in smaller companies and places where women are isolated, I don't just think, I know that young women continue to be harassed and assaulted. But what's better now is we talk about it and we call it out and we say it's wrong. And I say to young women, if you have a problem and you don't know where to go, you can always ring me. But fundamentally, the place to go is the police. These things that I suffered, a number of them were crimes, not jokes.
Your next music is a recording by the pianist Igor Levit, and I think it's connected with your experience of COVID during lockdown in 2020, 2021. That was a very difficult time for everyone. But what was your experience and how did you cope with it?
For me, lockdown was very difficult because I was living alone and I was also clinically vulnerable because I had been on a drug that makes you vulnerable for an autoimmune disease I have, giant cell arteritis. And if you remember at the beginning, we didn't know when or if it would ever end. We thought this might go on for years. And my daughter was living in Manchester, hundreds of miles away, and I felt so isolated and hopeless. And Igor Levitt started to do these concerts. When he sat in his house, he looked sad, like I felt sad, and a couple of times he actually broke down and cried while he played. And his empathy that he showed for all of us really helped me to get through it. And I'm sure that's true for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. This was classical music being used to remind us of our humanity and that we were all one and that one day we would all be together again.
the first movement of the Beethoven Piano Sonata in A-flat, Opus 110, played by Igor Levit. Dorothy Byrne, in 2003 you were appointed head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. As I mentioned at the start of the programme, you believe in the power of journalism to bring about change. Can you give me some examples of this from your own career, things you feel particularly strongly about, proud of?
Gosh, there are so many programmes that I feel proud of. The first programme that I ever produced and directed was about rape in marriage when it wasn't a crime. It now is a crime. I've made programmes about female genital mutilation. And may I say, Michael Barclay, you are a hero to women and children because you pushed through an amendment to the Children Act to protect children at risk of female genital mutilation. And I think not many people know that about you, but thank you.
Well, I always feel if that saves even one child, one little girl, that's something to feel proud of.
And that's what I feel about journalism, that sometimes it's about exposing something that's huge, and sometimes it's about helping one individual person. Also, it's about several journalists together doing something. There were terrible war crimes in Sri Lanka. Nobody cared about them. And I commissioned a film about it. And the president of Sri Lanka did a big press conference with all the journalists. And he said, "Are there any questions?" And the Channel 4 news journalist, Jonathan Miller, stood up and said, "What do you say about the Channel 4 programme about war crimes?" And he wouldn't answer. And he said, "Next question." And the next journalist from a different country stood up and said, "What do you say about the Channel 4 programme about war crimes?" And every single journalist from every country stood up and asked the same question, and he didn't answer them and he walked out. But that was the most wonderful example of all journalists getting together and saying, "We must all work together to expose something."
In 2020, you were elected president of a college at Cambridge University, Murray Edwards College. Did this come as a surprise?
Well, it was a surprise. They approached me. And actually, at first, I wrote back and said, I went to a convent and one all-female institution is enough in any one woman's life. Thank you very much. But they really won me over by explaining they're not anything like a convent. It's the most marvellous place. It supports and champions young women, but they go out and have their lectures in the university with men. Men can come and stay the night. They can come to dinner anytime they want. We have male fellows. So we're not an all-female institution, but we are an institution which supports and promotes young women in their studies.
You've actually got a female composer next, Amy Beach.
Yes, one of our fellows, her mother is Susan Tomes, and she came to tell us about her book, Women and the Piano, and she played 10 different female composers who I had never known many of them before, and one was Amy Beach. And Amy Beach was an American. She was brilliant, both as a player and a composer. And her parents wouldn't let her play in public. Then she married a doctor and he would only allow her to play in public once a year. But when he died, she was free, or at least that's how I think about it. And I love this piece, the Piano Concerto in C-sharp, because at the end, it feels like she's running free. And I like to think that this is how Amy Beach felt when at last she was free to compose and to play in public.
Thank you.
The finale of Amy Beach's Piano Concerto, performed by Danny Driver with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Rebecca Miller. It has a great joie de vivre, that ending.
Oh, it's so happy. And she talked herself about the great joy that music brought.
So you're able to encourage that creativity?
Oh, definitely. So we have two choirs, which we share with Churchill College next door, men and women singing together. And also, every Tuesday night, we have all different sorts of music. So people associate Cambridge with having absolutely perfect music, like King's College Choir. But we have karaoke jazz, we have people singing numbers from Disney. We just have such fun with our music. But we also have serious concerts as well. One of our alumni and our honorary fellow, Joanna McGregor, comes to play for us. And I learned so much from her. But it was Joanna McGregor who introduced me to a whole side of Nina Simone that I never knew before. Nina Simone to me was I'm feeling good. But Joanna told us how Nina Simone had wanted to be a classical musician. And it's through Joanna that I learned about the piece of music that I've chosen, Love Me or Leave Me, because you're listening to Nina Simone, jazz, and then suddenly you're in this Baroque music and you think, wow, where did that come from? But that came from the suppressed, hidden classical musician that she was. And I also do love the message of the song. You know, so many men keep women hanging on.
Say, love me, leave me, let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the night time the right time for kissing. Night time is my time for just reminiscing. Regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you. I intend to be independently blue. Say, hey, hey, I want your love, don't want to borrow. Have it today to give back tomorrow. Your love is my love, there's no love for nobody else.
I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the night time the right time for kissing. Nighttime is my time for just reminiscing, regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you. I intend to be independently blue. Hey, I want your love, don't want to borrow. Have it today to give back tomorrow. Your love is my love is your love. There's no love for nobody else.
Wonderful, wonderful playing as well as singing.
Brilliant playing. I was just, as we listened to it, thinking, wow, that is some pianist. It's just, it's perfect, isn't it?
Nina Simone with her 1966 version of the Walter Donaldson and Gus Kahn song, Love Me or Leave Me. I'm Michael Barclay and this is Private Passions on BBC Radio 3. My guest today is Dorothy Byrne, the former head of News and Current Affairs at Channel 4. For details of all Dorothy's music choices and to explore hundreds of previous episodes with guests like Raymond Blanc and Olivia Harrison, go to BBC Sounds. Now, you wrote a book, Dorothy, published in 2019, called Trust Me, I'm Not a Politician. The book's subtitle is A Simple Guide to Saving Democracy. Do you still feel that it's in peril, and what can we do about it?
I feel it even more strongly, because if we look at what happened in the US, and I'm fearful for what might happen again, we saw that a man who didn't win the election shouted and thousands of people rose up in agreement because they had been misinformed and stormed the Capitol in Washington. Who would ever have thought that American democracy could be in peril? So I think it's absolutely vital to democracy that we have very challenging journalism, and I will continue to be a journalist till the moment I die.
And from your point of view and your experience, ministers, for example, refusing to go on to the Today programme, is that of great concern for somebody who's had the kind of life you've had?
Yes. In the past, ministers took the view, well, this is part of the job. I have to do it. I have to put myself up for really challenging interviews. Margaret Thatcher, whatever you think of her, put herself up for very long interviews with the likes of Jon Snow. Now, government ministers think they can just do little soundbites on the news when they're visiting a factory. Also, in the past, politicians tried to avoid telling the truth. They tried to elide the truth, but they didn't lie in the flagrant way that we see now. And I think it's for journalists, all journalists, to call out these lies, because your average voter doesn't have the time to go away and investigate whether something's true or not. That's our job. And I was criticised by some people for saying that the then Prime Minister was a liar. But I think it's actually key that when politicians tell lies, we tell people, because otherwise they won't know.
Well, we've been talking about the wonderful musical life at Cambridge, so perhaps we should have your own choir singing something. What have you chosen?
We have to hear from our chamber choir. And I've chosen a piece by Hildegard von Bingen, because I'm always partial to a Roman Catholic mystic woman.
The first female composer we know of.
And a fantastic composer. And what I love about this is that the person who you first hear singing is a computer science student, Summer Lee. I love the fact that you don't have to be a music student to love and take part in music of a very, very high quality. This is simply and purely and utterly beautiful.
O Virtus Sapiente, an antiphon for divine wisdom by Hildegard of Bingen, performed by the all-female Inter Alios Chamber Choir of students from Churchill and Murray Edwards Colleges, Cambridge, conducted by Rosie Dunn. Dorothy Byrne, when you gave your MacTaggart lecture in 2019, you were then 66, the oldest woman to have ever done so. You referred to yourself as the Methuselah of television. And you ask, where are all the other old ladies? Well, you're now 71, although I don't think of you as old at all sitting here. Why are there so few older women in the upper echelons of the media?
There are far fewer older women in general in our society in high places. A key problem is that after the menopause, lots of women just give up work. We know that 10% of women give up work because of the effects of the menopause. And it also happens often at the same time as their children are undergoing exams and their parents are becoming elderly, and those responsibilities get thrown on them. So they they just sort of give up. But there has historically been great prejudice against old ladies. Well, even the fact we're called old ladies, we're called hags, witches.
They're not titles that are given to men.
No, there's no... And if you look at TV, I mean, David Dimbleby went on in TV till he was like 256, as far as I could see.
Attenborough.
David Attenborough. I'm not saying that these are not wonderful men who should continue, but where are all the old women? Actually, even to do my job at Cambridge, they had to change the rules because you had to retire at 70. So they had to change the statute. And just before the Queen died, the Queen in Privy Council changed the rules of Murray Edwards College so that I could continue. Technically, I could continue forever, but Murray Edwards College needn't be worried. I won't.
How would the news we consume actually be different if there were more women like you at the top?
News and current affairs would be very different in its content if it was more representative. And to give you a clear example, I commissioned, just before I left Channel 4, a film about the menopause. One of my colleagues said to me, well, nobody will watch that, only old ladies will watch it. And I said, well, it's a good job, there are lots of old ladies then, isn't it? But actually what happened, it was presented by Davina McCall, it was a huge hit. If you change who makes the programmes, you change the content of the programmes. We need more older women everywhere.
What music are we going to finish with?
Well, I like to plan, so I've planned my funeral. I tried to buy the plot, but the graveyard wouldn't let me because I thought if I got in quick, I'd get it a bit cheaper. But they said that I couldn't buy a plot until I was terminally ill or 84. But I'm 71, so not that long to go. I know where I'm going to have my funeral, and I've chosen the music. So the first piece is going to be Handel in English, Let Me Weep, because it's heartbreaking and everybody will cry. Well, I hope they will. I mean, I expect them to cry. But then the music will get happier and happier throughout. So it will end up being a very happy occasion.
Well, let's hear Lascia ch'io pianga from Handel's Rinaldo. Thank you very much indeed, Dorothy Byrne.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope I've made people cry.
Thank you.
The aria Lascia ch'io pianga from Handel's opera Rinaldo, sung by the soprano Sandrine Pio. It was the final choice of Michael Barclay's Private Passions guest today, the journalist Dorothy Byrne. The programme was produced by Graham Rogers. Michael's guest next week is the physicist and broadcaster Brian Cox, who'll be mixing Mahler and Richard Strauss with jazz improvisations by Keith Jarrett. That's Private Passions next Sunday here on Radio 3 at just after midday.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
The place where we celebrate live music and the musicians who perform it.
What he thought would be a small chamber music workshop turned into a full orchestra.
I've been given carte blanche to dig into the different ways gardens and music influence each other.
Music is about people, it's about people coming together.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
The perfect soundscape for whatever you're doing.
Listen on your radio, on your smart speaker, and on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. Choral Evensong is at 3 o'clock, and it's a service given as part of the St David's Music Festival in Pembrokeshire, first heard on Wednesday. But now it's 1:30, and time to join Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Music Map, Radio 3's Sunday afternoon musical journey, where we weave a web of sonic connections around a single piece of music, charting a course through musical time and space. Today, we're heading for the Day of Judgment. The earth-shattering depiction of Judgment Day, Dies Irae, from Giuseppe Verdi's Requiem. The Requiem is a massive piece, and if I was going to play you the whole thing on today's Music Map, we wouldn't have time for anything else. So I've chosen the final movement, the Liberame, as our destination. It contains a lot of the same music that appears throughout the earlier parts of the piece. It's like a summing up at the end. But the Liberame is actually where Verdi began. It was the very first bit of his Requiem that he wrote, and it started life as part of a project to honour the passing of this great Italian composer.